I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Doug Tompkins, co-founder of North Face, the outdoor apparel company, and the clothing company Esprit. Doug started North Face in 1963 with a few thousand dollars, and he sold the company 7 years later for $50,000. He started Esprit in 1968 with his first wife, Susie Russell, and Jane Tice, and sold his interest in the American Esprit Company in 1990. After spending roughly 25 years in the retail business world, Doug has moved on to Chapter 2, committing all of his time to conservation, environmentalism, and farming operations with his wife, Christine Tompkins, in Chile and Argentina. I'm sitting with Doug at his mother's home in Millbrook, New York, on one of his trips back from South America. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So I'd like to talk about where it all began. You were born in 1943. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in West Village, New York City, for the first 5 years. And then my parents moved up here to Millbrook.
What was the impetus for them moving out of the city?
Oh, I think my dad just had it with city life. He wanted to live in the country and rural, under rural conditions. And he was a private antique dealer. And so he could be anywhere. He also had a little airplane. And he flew all around New England and, down probably as far as Virginia and so forth, dealing with clients or looking at pieces of furniture to buy or, talking to museums and so forth. So he had the freedom to live up here in the country. So found this place where we are right now, and that's how it began.
Your father seems like an adventurer to some extent. To what extent do you think your father influenced your interests in environmentalism and the natural environment?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't think he was much of an adventurer in that sense. But while I was living here and growing up, at 12 years old, a neighbor here in Millbrook took me to the Shawangunk Cliffs across the river by New Paltz, near Poughkeepsie, and introduced me to rock climbing. That was a decisive sort of shift in the road or in my trajectory in life, which was more country gentry, Millbrook, New York, private schools and so forth. And suddenly I fell in with a whole different crowd of Beat Generation in those days, rock climbers, mostly from New York City, adventurers, vagabonds, and so forth. And that changed my personal destiny.
Consistent with that was you went to a private school. You went to Pomfret, and you were expelled from Pomfret. Why were you expelled?
Oh, I was not made for school. The idea of being confined in school and the scholarship just didn't fit my developing personality, and I couldn't get back to school, and I had girlfriends in Providence that lured me over there on the weekends, and I'd be, repeatedly failing to get back to school and one thing or another. So it seemed like a relief. I came back and took 1 year in public school, high school here in Millbrook. The day the school was out, I was on my way to the Grand Tetons to go climbing or to Yosemite, I forget, but out to the Western States. I never really looked back at formal education.
So you move out west and you start North Face in 1963 selling outdoor climbing gear. What was the catalyst for starting the company?
Well, I first started a company called the California Mountaineering Guide Service in 1963. That was to guide clients through the mountains of Wyoming, the Wind River Mountains, the Grand Tetons, up to the Bugaboo Mountains in Canada and to the Canadian Rockies on usually a month-long trip. And we also needed to provide gear for our clients. So I started a small little shop in conjunction with the guide service. But towards the end of 1963, I moved down to the Bay Area, down to Berkeley. I ran into someone in San Francisco that had a ski shop, and he didn't want to sell things in the summertime. He only wanted to sell things in the winter. So for the first summer, I took over that shop as the North Face and sold climbing gear. But by the middle of the summer, he had found another place that he liked downtown and decided to open a ski shop downtown. So I stayed there and maintained the shop all year And that's how the North Face got started. And eventually opened another shop in Stanford, in Palo Alto, California. And then we had also a wholesale business. I was importing things from Europe, and I was distributing the hardware made by my friend and climbing partner and manufacturer, Yvon Chouinard, that made the Chouinard mountaineering equipment.
And Yvon Chouinard, who eventually founded Patagonia.
And he eventually founded Patagonia.
So you started this outdoor equipment business mainly to supply your clients.
Initially, the equipment business continued to expand. We got into the mail order business. We sold ski equipment in the wintertime as well. And the North Face was sort of off and going.
How did you come up with the name North Face?
Well, the North Face, of course, in the Northern Hemisphere is usually the steep and dramatic face and the hardest to climb. So it symbolized to climbers the real challenge of most mountains.
You started the company with a few thousand dollars. Where did you get the capital?
Well, I was a born worker. I have to credit my parents for making me a little entrepreneur from a very young age, where I started to raise chickens. And I ordered chickens through the mail, and I had a little chicken house up here just up on the hill. And I bought grain for chickens, and I tended these chickens. And then when they were mature, I slaughtered the chickens and froze them and sold them to the local supermarket. And I started to save money and put money in the bank. My parents were very emphatic and strict that I had my own savings account. And this is at a young age. I'm talking about 9, 10 years old. And then I got to buy some sheep. I started to sell the sheep in the county fairs and so forth. So on our little farm here, I was the little, child farmer here. So I began to save a little money, and I had to have a bank account, and I was watching carefully, and it was became quite interested that you could earn interest and that your money could grow without apparently doing anything, you see? And this was sort of a miracle to me. I found this astounding, that because I was having to work fairly hard on my chickens and sheep, but the fact that I could put this money in the bank and it would expand on its own, was a marvel to behold. So eventually I accumulated maybe $100, which in the early 1950s was a good little sum of money. I was given some advice by my parents to check on the idea of buying some stock in a company. And so here in Millbrook, one of the past presidents of Chase Manhattan Bank at the time lived here in Millbrook and was sort of my godfather in a sense. So at 12 years old, I made an appointment to talk business and talk finance. And so he suggested an insurance company of North America. And I said, well, how much stock would I get? And he said, well, how much money do you have? I said, well, I have about $100. And so he said, well, that would get you one share. And I said, one share for my whole $100, which I thought was a lot, seemed like a very paltry deal to me. So I reluctantly agreed to do it. And I was kind of glum about that because, I wasn't going to really see anything. But by good luck, within a few months, the stock split 2-1. And suddenly, my investment had doubled. And then, sure enough, in another year, I got a dividend. And then the stock split again a couple years later. And so I was in the stock market. And I was, a little financial investor out there.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Doug Tompkins, founder of North Face, the outdoor apparel company, and the clothing company Esprit. Doug started North Face in 1963 with a few thousand dollars that he had earned as a child entrepreneur raising sheep and chickens, and also as a financier in the North American Insurance Company. You sold the company. You sold North Face just a few years after you started it. How come you sold the company?
Well, it was 7 or 8 years later, around 1970. The company grew very rapidly, And I didn't have much capital at all. I borrowed some money from the Bank of America on the corner there in North Beach in San Francisco, which turned out to be a good thing. I'll get to that in a minute. But I was always, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul to keep the company growing. And I started to realize that I was, everywhere I went, I was having to talk about, you know, climbing equipment with everybody. And that was kind of a drag. And I thought, this I don't need. And I shouldn't have gotten into a business that's related to the sport that I really like. So I sold it to a couple of brothers that had a ski shop in the East Bay.
And when you see what North Face has become years later, do you wish you hadn't sold so early? Are you surprised by what it's become?
Not at all.
And you then started a company that was outside the mountaineering equipment space.
Actually, I had a bit of a business in between. I was making documentary films, and we made a film on a trip that we took to South America in 1968 in a van where we drove from California to Patagonia, surfing, skiing, high mountain skiing, and climbing. And we climbed the Fitzroy Mountain in Patagonia and did a first ascent there. And we made a film about that. And it turned out to be the inspiration, so to speak, for a film called 180 Degrees South.
At around this time, you had married your first wife, Susie Russell.
That was sort of, I was helping my ex-wife, Susie Russell Tompkins, and Jane Tice, our partner at the time, to get the Esprit Company going.
But at the time, it wasn't called the Esprit Company. What was it called?
Oh, we started it with a trade style named Plain Jane.
Why did you call it Esprit?
We needed a name that had corporation written in it. And so we used the play on words. We were also anti-war activists at those times. And so we used the slogan for the Marine Corps, which was Esprit de Corps of the Marine Corps. And we also used the idea that we'd gotten from the Beatles that used Apple Corps as the name of their company. So we used the play on words of Esprit de Corps so we didn't have to write a corporation in our name. And it got started that way. Eventually, around the company, we referred to the company as Esprit. We just made its nickname. And then we used that as a trade style. And that became, you know, a very popular brand.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Doug Tompkins, co-founder of North Face and Esprit, and a pioneer in conservation philanthropy. We'll hear more from Doug coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Doug Tompkins, co-founder of North Face, the outdoor apparel company, and the clothing company Esprit. After spending roughly 25 years in the retail business world, Doug has moved on to chapter two, committing all of his time to conservation, environmentalism, and farming operations with his wife, Christine Tompkins, in Chile and Argentina. I'm sitting with Doug at his mother's home in Millbrook, New York, on one of his trips back from South America. By the way, I want to go back to before you said that you borrowed some money from the Bank of America when you were launching North Face, and you said that was a good idea. Why was that a good move on your part?
Well, my dad was a fellow who never borrowed money, and he was very strict on credit. And he said if you did borrow money, you have to borrow well within your means to repay, and that it was a good idea to even take out loans that you really didn't need and pay them back because you would build up a credit history. Although we did need some of the loans initially with the North Face, we took out a bunch of loans that we didn't really need, and we paid back. We started to build up a good history with the local bank. Later, in the early years of Esprit, and I was working on our documentary films, and was putting what money we had into the documentary films to get them finished and sell to television, I went down to see my friend, the Italian banker at Bank of America, and because we had a history of banking with that branch there, he loaned us money to get the Esprit company started. Then, as the company grew very rapidly, we needed more and more credit, and we were about to sell half of the company to an investor. We found an investor who was anxious to put in money. And we're not talking about big money. We're talking like $15,000. It was half of the value of the company. So we took the, we said, okay, we'll do that. Then it turned out that this investor had defrauded his wife's trust fund, and the parents had sued him, and the courts had awarded all his assets to the family. And I'd already taken out some capital to finance our films. We were short of money. So this creditworthiness came in real handy because we got the ownership of the company back, and that was the initial capitalization of Esprit.
So here you are, you sold North Face, you're now starting Esprit, and oh, by the way, on the side, you're making documentaries. It seems like you're a little bit all over the place. Where did you commit most of your energy?
Well, I was focused on getting Esprit started in the beginning, and I was doing the organization and administration, and the girls were doing the design and the selling. And in fact, because the business just took off like a shot, I was distracted from the documentary film business. In fact, I stopped the documentary film business because I was so busy trying to sort of keep the bull by the horns.
You started Esprit selling dresses out of a van, and you talk about growth skyrocketing. Why did the company do so well so quickly?
Well, good idea. And I really give it to Jane and Susie. Jane had been living in Europe. She had seen the kind of clothes that she liked that were not available. She was a fashion model in Europe. She came back with a lot of dresses, and they all her girlfriends, including Susie, said, oh, you know, this is great. Too bad they don't sell these here. And she said, well, why don't we start a boutique, and we'll make them in the back room, and we'll sell them out the front. They came to me and said, well, this is what we want to do, but we really don't know how to organize this, and you're good at organizing this. You know, you've got the North Face going. And I said, one of the reasons of getting out of the North Face was that we were shopkeepers, and shopkeepers meant hours and meeting the public, and I don't like hours nor meeting the public. And I don't want to do any more of that. We just got finished with that, you see. But if we would sell things wholesale and let other people be the shopkeepers, then we can come and go as we please. We don't have to meet the public. We don't have to get dressed up. We don't have to keep hours. And we'll be free, and I can go climbing when I want to and ski racing and so forth. So they sort of reluctantly agreed to that because it was kind of, you know, when there weren't that many options. And we set about a little business plan that we would choose the best 10 department stores, the best 10 specialty chains, and the best 10 boutiques. And those were the 30 accounts that we wanted to get, which we thought was something within our capabilities. And the buyers there just thought they were terrific and wrote huge orders. And I think the first order they went, they got like a $50,000 order.
And by the 1980s, Esprit had about $1 billion in sales. What was harder for you all than you thought it would be?
Well, it was a big shift in the industry where direct retailers were really at the forefront of the market, and many of them using our ideas and copying us. So we also wanted to shift then into retail business so that we could be vertical producers, that is, design, produce, and sell directly to the public.
Was there one turning point or one phenomenon in the industry that caused you to be successful even further?
I think the most important thing, and the thing that we were copied most around the world and we received the most applause for, was our advertising and brand identification campaigns. We had a really good image-making team, and we extended that comprehensively to everything we did, from the labeling to packaging to retail presentations to showrooms. And that, I think, is pretty conclusively, when you look back at it, the reason that we were very successful. And there were thousands of competitors. I mean, we had thousands of competitors, and it was a huge industry, the clothing business. It's trillions of dollars worldwide. So to emerge as an absolute leader, though, you have to be doing something, you know, right.
You've talked about beauty as a basic And this is in the context of your preservation and conservation efforts with the environment. But it seems like you've had a focus on the aesthetic life going back to a spree. But does it relate at all to your upbringing with your father being an antique dealer? Like, did he have a specific eye and emphasis on beauty? Where does that interest of yours come from?
Yeah, I can tell you very definitely. My dad was a big influence on me. When I was a little kid, I used to go around with him to the auction houses and to, he'd go to see a client, a private person, and maybe have a house like this that was selling some piece of furniture. And I was, a little kid with a big mouth, and I used to go around with him, and I'd be opining and making judgments about, how good this was and how good that was. And so he said, listen, I'm tired of hearing you tell me how good something is when you don't know what you're talking about. So you've got to take this book, and I want you to study this book. And when you start to get the idea, then you can start making some of these judgments.
What was the book?
And the book was a book on antiques. And it was a book that showed a good example, or a poor example, a good example, and a great example of a given style. So he made me study this. He put my nose in that book. And then he started to test me. This, I'm talking, I'm 11, 12 years old. And so I grew up in that milieu. And that was very helpful.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Doug Tompkins, founder of North Face, the outdoor apparel company, and the clothing company Esprit. Doug started North Face in 1963 with a few thousand dollars and sold the company 7 years later for about $50,000. He started Esprit in 1968 and sold his interest in the American company in 1990. Doug has moved on to a chapter two in his life, committing all of his time to conservation, environmentalism, and farming operations in Chile and Argentina. You sold your American interest in 1990. You and your wife divorced, and you moved down to Patagonia. You had been to Patagonia a few years prior with Yvon Chouinard, the founder of the clothing company Patagonia. Was the idea of moving down to South America full-time something that was it an impulsive idea, or was it something that was kind of lingering in your mind that you wanted to do for a while?
Well, by the mid-1980s, I started to get a little bit saturated and bored with business. I started to become interested in environmental issues, and I started doing more and more reading, more and more scholarship. And I realized that this constant consumption, this growth, growth without end, was just consuming the natural world through over-exploitation of resources. And eco-philosophy and eco-ethics were particularly interesting to me because they tied into my life in the mountains and wild places. So by 1987 or 88, I started thinking about getting out of business and really devoting my efforts to environmentalism specifically. Not so much in land conservation, but in environmental work.
What part of your motivation had to do with your penchant towards being kind of a reclusive individual? You mentioned before that you weren't as interested in retail at North Face and seeing customers every day. What part of you wanted kind of just the romantic simplicity of moving to South America and kind of just being on your own?
Well, at that stage, I didn't have any pretensions or intentions of moving to South America. I wasn't absolutely sure what I wanted to do. And I started getting involved in activism from Northern California. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a particularly reclusive type person by any stretch of the imagination, although I love the outdoors and wild places. And I like the rural atmosphere. It doesn't mean that I'm reclusive by any stretch of the imagination. I like to think of myself as a social creature too, and especially in terms of having to be involved with people and even with the urban environments in order to make social change. And you can't do that in the middle of nowhere. You have to be engaged.
You ultimately disconnected from Esprit altogether and devoted yourself 100% to these environmental issues. And you ended up buying over 2 million acres of land in Chile and Argentina How did you end up focusing on that part of the world?
I've been going to Chile since 1961. And in 1990, after selling the company, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do. But I had a little light airplane. I flew down to South America, down to Chile and Argentina, actually together with another friend and his wife, who was a pilot, photographer Galen Rowell, fairly well-known American landscape photographer. And we flew our two little planes together to South America. And while we were there, he was doing a story for the National Geographic. We were shown a farm that was for sale on the Chilean coast. And I rather impulsively bought that farm because it was so beautiful and seemed so reasonable in price. And that sort of put me in Chile in that sense.
And you've bought over 2 million acres. From whom did you buy the land?
Mostly we bought from large absentee landowners. I think we're maybe around 2.3 million acres of land in both Chile and Argentina, and only about 0.7%, less than 1%, was bought from small landowners. Most all of them were big chunks owned by sometimes foreigners, not even nationals, and virtually not one of them living there. So by and large, they were from large landowners.
Now, conservation philanthropy is a tradition in the United States, but is unprecedented in a place like Chile or Argentina. And your efforts were met with a lot of opposition. What was the nature of some of that opposition that you faced in the early days?
Wild accusations that, you know, you're monopolizing all the granite that are in those peaks, or that you're going to replace the local cows with American buffaloes, or you're digging tunnels under the Andes, or that you're, you know, stealing water. First of all, it's good to make a quick review of American conservation, which has faced nothing but opposition for a century and a half. John Muir, if he were here today, would be able to tell us some magnificent stories about opposition to conservation. The formation of the 77 national parks in the United States, virtually every one of them has faced stiff opposition. So that's nothing new. But you also know that the pattern shifts. And if you look at historically, just here in the United States, you will see that opposition turns into something quite different as the years go by. And suddenly you find that the land in question is fiercely defended by local people rather than opposing it. And today, for example, if you were to go to Yosemite, or you were to go to the Grand Canyon, or you were to go to Yellowstone or any of the great iconic parks in the United States and run a campaign to eliminate those parks, they would string you up at the local lamppost.
A large part of your time is spent on farming operations, agriculture. Can you describe that a little more?
Well, as part of our environmental and conservation work, we think that agriculture is a key issue, and that, in fact, if agriculture and the problems of agriculture, not just in agriculture, are not contended with and faced and reversed, that there's no reversing the eco-social crisis itself, because agriculture occupies more of the landscapes and puts more impacts on the landscape than any other activity. We're talking about global climate change. We're talking about soils. We live on approximately 6 inches of topsoils around the world, which is the difference between life and desolation. So consequently, I've had a great deal of interest in ranching, pastoral agriculture, and in cultivating agriculture. So we have family farms in both Argentina and Chile, and we're interested in making those, you know, good examples of how we can make a truly biologically sustainable agriculture.
There's so much dirt created in the air from irresponsible agriculture that the white sheep have become brown.
Yes.
What is that about?
The overgrazing has created so much dust, or so much bare ground, and the movement of animals put so much dust in the air that you can actually see it in the color of the sheep. The wool is brown from so much dust. And it's, of course, a a vicious circle there. As the sheep are churning up more and more dust, you're losing more and more topsoil, so less and less grass is growing and deteriorating the quality of grasslands.
How is your diet?
My diet? I'm not on a diet. I eat whatever I want.
What I mean by diet is, do you eat only organic foods without pesticides?
Yes, first of all, on our farms, we're all organic in management. We use no chemicals. So we have nice, healthy food, and we have good gardens. So when I come up here and I have to travel around, I feel like I'm in a sort of a minefield in terms of what I have to eat, because I have to eat industrial foods. And I know very well from years of campaigns and being immersed in the issue of agriculture that you could be eating anything. So it makes me very nervous.
Your wife, Chris Tompkins, was the former CEO of Patagonia until 1993, and she too is very devoted to land preservation and wildlife conservation. How is it working with her on a project of mutual interest?
Well, of course, I worked with Susie for many years on a project of mutual interest. So for me, I see it perfectly normal. My mother and father worked on projects of mutual interest. So I think that's a good way to be married. Chris and I really see eye to eye, and I think we work fantastically together and much stronger as a couple than we would be as two individuals.
Thank you very much for joining us.
No, it's a pleasure.
My guest has been Doug Tompkins, founder of North Face, Esprit, and a pioneer in the environmental conservation space. Coming up, we'll meet Connie Duckworth, founder of Arzu, an organization that provides economic empowerment to women in Afghanistan. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and pro bono president of Arzu, a nonprofit organization that aims to provide sustainable income to impoverished Afghan women. Arzu sources rugs from weavers in Afghanistan, sells them in the United States, and compensates these women at above market rates. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S. Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was the situation that you first encountered among impoverished women in Afghanistan when you visited there in 2002?
I felt like I was stepping back in time 2,000 years. Not only is it so different culturally, but it had been a country that was subject to almost 25 years of nonstop warfare. Kabul looked like Berlin after World War II, flattened rubble. And we went into a bombed-out school building. There were literally hundreds of women and children, widows and their children, living in this shelter. To the best of their ability, they had put plastic bags over some of the gaps in the windows. There was no furniture, no water, no sanitation, no cooking facilities, nothing. And these women were surviving the winter in this building. And I looked at them, and I couldn't help but thinking, that could be me. That could be any one of us, but for the quirk of fate of where we were born. I have to say, that was the tipping point. And I came back on the plane from that first trip saying, what can I do personally to try to make some difference?
What about citizenship? Is there a lack of formal citizenship among these women?
Well, since the fall of the Taliban, there has been a concerted international and national effort to basically include women in the future of Afghanistan. And before the various wars, before the invasion of the Russians, women did have an active role as citizens in Afghanistan. There was a constitution from the 60s. Women were professionals. And because it's a gender-segregated society, 50% of the physicians were women. So they played an active role. That was all, in effect, wiped away. And you have a generation of women with no education because the Taliban precluded women from leaving their homes.
It's interesting that this disenfranchisement of women is kind of a recent phenomenon. As you were saying, 50 years ago, they enjoyed, if not equal rights to men, better rights than existed during the Taliban era. And now we're getting back to some semblance of democracy to some extent. So you're on the plane coming back from Afghanistan to the United States thinking, okay, well, what can I do? What impact can I make? Why rugs?
Well, the first idea wasn't really rugs. I kind of backed into that idea. I see the world through a business lens because of my business background. And so I naturally think that the solution to most imminent problems is economic empowerment. So I thought jobs. We're going to get these women jobs because when a woman can earn a living, it's well documented, the first thing she'll do is educate her children and then lift the community as a whole. So not knowing much about Afghanistan, I naturally thought, well, let's open some factories. Garment factory. Couple of issues with that. Gee, is there electricity? No. Can you provide security? No. Is there water? No. Well, another couple of problems. The women couldn't leave their homes to go to a factory to work. So what I rapidly learned was to retreat from that ill-thought-out idea. And the bottom line we came up with is that about the only thing that women could culturally do in an acceptable way was to work in their homes. And rugs have been made by women for millennia, often with the patterns passed down from mother to daughter, often woven by memory, although the rug industry had been extremely dislocated given all the years of war. And many of the patterns were being lost. But rugs were almost the default position. It can be done in a woman's home. She knows how to do it. And it was the highest margin product I could think of because the point of all this is to kick off cash.
And what was the reaction of some of these families or of these women whom you targeted?
We go to the village elders first, and we sit down and explain what Arzu is. And we get permission to work in the village. If the elders don't want us in the village, we go to a different village. We then go to the household level. We approach the patriarch first. And if the patriarch agrees that we can work with that family, we then speak to the women. So because, again, it's gender segregated, we have a staff that involves men and women. The men talk to the men and the women talk to the women.
You mentioned that you have male monitors and female monitors, and the men talk to the patriarchs in the family, and the women speak to the matriarchs in the family. Is there ever a problem with communication between them? Can the monitors talk to each other?
When we started our expansion into northern Afghanistan in the Turkmen area, we hired a young woman monitor and a young man. Well, we'd be getting these internet reports back. And we'd look at them and there'd be these discrepancies. And we're like, what is wrong? Are they not talking to each other? Well, then we sort of said that facetiously. Turned out they weren't talking to each other. They weren't related. So therefore, they could not meet, even though they were both employed by our company, in a public place together. So we solved the problem by hiring the nephew of the woman, who also, oh, by the way, knew some computer skills, which was good. And then the three of them could meet.
Now, is this rule a vestige or a result of the Taliban rule? Or is this part of the Muslim law? Where is this rule from that the men can't talk to the women?
It's really a vestige of traditional tribal customs. And it is a very religious country. So there's definitely an Islamic overlay. But the differences we see from conservative to more liberal is vast. Our area in Bamiyan, which is the central part of Afghanistan, is a very, quote, easy area for us to work in because the people there seem much more open-minded. So there we see a greater ability for men and women to be speaking together versus in the Andahoy region where religiously the people are more conservative.
So in a region like the Andahoy region, did you face resistance among families?
We did at the outset before we had any local reputation. We'd face families that would say no interest. And if a family didn't elect to work with us, we moved to a different household and a different family. But I will tell you, The first time we paid a bonus, because we pay a 50% quality cash bonus when the rug is completed, we were oversubscribed in that village the next day.
So those families who had resisted initially saw their neighbors getting a bonus and getting more income, and so then they signed up?
Yes. In Bamiyan, we had researched a couple of different villages to decide where we were going to start when we expanded into that area, and we selected one village. About 6 months later, we received a formal delegation of men from the other village with a written petition signed by all the elders, men and women, asking Arzu to come to their village.
You talk about men reaching out to you. Are there men weavers? Do some of the men want to weave?
It depends, again, on the tribe. If it's traditional that the men weave, we allow them to weave. We always have a master weaver, though, who is the woman.
And is there ever resentment among some of the men in these communities that the women are getting income and gaining empowerment?
Not so much within the family itself, but we have had situations where some of the middlemen that Arzu is disintermediating, we've had men who were paying women subpar rates to weave, badmouth us and go around and tell other villagers that, you know, you can't trust Arzu, don't weave for them, they don't know what they're doing.
Has your security ever felt compromised when you were there?
We have taken the approach that we want to be as local as possible and as invisible of an organization as possible on the ground. From time to time, when violence kicks up, there'll be spates, periodic spates of suicide bombings, etc. We try to monitor this random violence as much as possible, but if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, it's a problem.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu, an organization that connects female weavers in Afghanistan with rug buyers in the United States. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. I want to talk about the economics of these rugs. How much do they sell for in the United States? What's the range?
The range, depending on size and pattern, of course, is between roughly $1,000 and $15,000.
How much is the weaver seeing?
There's a going labor rate for weaving rugs. So we'll pay the high end of the market rate plus 50% of that. Normally, a woman would go into debt to purchase materials that she would then use her labor to weave the rug. And then she'd turn the rug over to someone else who would charge her to finish the rug and then would go sell it. And at the end of the process would come back and say, here's your money. What we've done is we provide the highest quality materials. We've also systematically gone through and replaced looms or provided looms. A loom is, in effect, her biggest capital asset. And I'd say maybe one or two out of 100 weavers might have actually owned a loom. What we, in effect, are doing is taking her from a risk position as an entrepreneur and converting her into a salaried employee so that she has a dependable income that we pay not at the end of the process but throughout the process so she can put food on the table today.
You also are supplying other benefits to these women and their families, such as health care and education. Can you describe that a little bit?
That's the literacy classes that we're establishing in the village. That's the basic access to health care. It's transportation to clinics and hospitals for pregnant women. We've built a school in one village. We've looked at water catchment systems, and we're undertaking the construction of one of those because water's a very big area. We've been researching alternative livelihood. What that really means is jobs for men in the village. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at some small food processing plants. All of the proceeds from the sale of rugs here goes to support the entire closed-loop Arzu system. So all of the money from a particular sale does not go directly to a particular woman, but funds all of the projects.
What's an example of a woman who has benefited from Arzu?
So one of our earliest weavers was a widow named Hamida. And Hamida happens to have two daughters who are the ages of my two daughters. Hamida was a widow. She was a refugee in Pakistan, suffered greatly, and she started weaving for Arzu. When Hamida, a year after starting our literacy classes, and everyone, when we started literacy classes, was in grade one. Didn't matter if you were 50 or 12 or 25. She said, learning to read was like a blind woman getting her eyes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and president of Arzu. Prior to starting Arzu, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs, where she worked for over 20 years. Connie is also the author of The Old Girls Network, a book for female entrepreneurs and businesswomen. How did you raise capital for Arzu?
Well, I funded the first 18 months personally. We'll call that friends and family money. Then we applied for a seed grant from USAID, the Agency for International Development. USAID invested over a three-year period a total of $2 million.
How does one find an Arzu rug?
Well, the best place to go is to our website, which is arzurugs.org. And Arzu, by the way, means hope in Dari, and it's also a common woman's name. Dari is one of the many tribal languages in Afghanistan.
So I want to talk about your prior professional history. You were at Goldman Sachs for 20 years.
That's right.
But while you were at Goldman, you led kind of an entrepreneurial life to some degree within Goldman Sachs. What is an example of a project that you started within Goldman?
Well, I was tapped in 1990 probably by Bob Rubin to start a diversity initiative. Now, sitting here today in 2007, you think, well, what's so novel about that? At the time, that was not a word that was widely utilized, certainly not in Wall Street, but anywhere in corporate America. It was an undefined term. And so I was told to start this, and I had no idea what this was. But over the next 5 years, we basically implemented all of the family-friendly type policies, job sharing. We had the first daycare backup center in Wall Street in New York, where people whose child care fell through could bring their child, man or woman, bring their child for the day. Maternity, adoption leave. So really all of the kinds of policies that help improve the workplace and the work environment.
You mentioned that Bob Rubin came to you. He became later the Secretary of Treasury during the Clinton administration. I've heard that he said, "I hear you can get things done." Why did you have that reputation at Goldman, do you think, for getting things done?
Well, I think it comes from having grown up in the bond department, which is the, for those who ever read Liar's Poker, that book from the 80s, it was very much transaction-based. And so we were trading hundreds of millions of dollars of securities in a single trade at a single moment. And so execution was paramount.
Now, in addition to word of mouth and having people just go to your website to buy the rugs, you've also had cocktail parties at Goldman Sachs, for example, where you have all women of all ages come and buy these rugs.
Oh, yes. The firm has been very supportive and also is the proud owner of some Arzu rugs for the executive floors. One of the benefits of having a long business career is that it gives me a good Rolodex, and I have been quite shameless in levering that Rolodex to ask people for help.
After you left Goldman, in addition to starting Arzu, you also wrote a book called The Old Girls Network, which tries to help women entrepreneurs and women in corporate America kind of deal in a man's world. What were some of the issues that you faced being a woman at Goldman Sachs?
When I first got out of business school and was even applying for jobs, I was still being told, now this is ancient history, but in the late 70s by some of the companies that I interviewed with that, well, we don't hire women. Now, you definitely wouldn't hear that one today, but I would say basically I've typically been the only woman in the room. And now I sit, from a business perspective, I sit on several corporate boards. And that seems to now be, at least in popular press, one of the last bastions of male-dominated business arenas.
It's striking to me, and this might seem ridiculous at first, the similarities almost between the women you're trying to empower in Afghanistan and the women you've tried to promote here in the United States, whether it's through your book or through Goleman, just this notion of financial independence.
I think that's a very interesting observation because I do very much see the linkage. I have come to believe over the course of my career that there's a dignity that comes with work. I think that, and I see it in Afghanistan, I think the right to work and to have a value placed on your work is really a basic human need and a basic human right.
In your book, I was struck there was a female pioneer venture capitalist receiving an award, and she comes up on stage onto the podium to receive the reward. And she said, "Does this microphone work for women too?"
I have a little personal saying, which is, "She who writes the check controls the agenda." And I think that's true in politics. I think it's true in business. I think it's true in every venue.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu.
To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.